Coming over here to speak for a while about this practice, I was reflecting on how it's being presented as a journey and how much I appreciate doing this journey with you. I'm very much a practitioner at this retreat, I feel. And I also am journeying along. And we're companions in each other's journey. And we travel individually with companions, but we also travel together as a community. And in many ways, we're also growing as a community. This particular one, for this retreat, for the wider circle of people practicing with IRC and IMC, together with all the many different forms of communities, the kinds of communities which are doing insight meditation in this country and maybe around the world, we're journeying together. In some ways we're journeying together with everyone in this country, in this northern hemisphere, in both hemispheres, in this world. We can't help but to be together journeying. We're all together here. And I certainly appreciate that we have gathered together for this journey. And I was thinking about this simile of the chariots, relay chariots, and the way that it's just a simile, so we have permission not to take it too seriously. So I thought I would change it, which is what Brian did anyway. So he started it. gave me permission. And so an alternative simile, an alternative universe, it's not seven stages that the horses are going. Go with one chariot and horse, and then you change, and next one, and next one. But rather, it's the same chariot. And as it's being pulled along, at some point, a second horse comes along and joins it. So now there's two horses pulling it. And then, a little bit further along, a third one joins, and a fourth, a fifth, a sixth, and a seventh. And they're all coming together to pull our chariot. So one of the things we're doing here is Brian talked about collecting as concentration. We're collecting not just horses, but we're collecting friends, lots of friends. So because we don't leave behind these stages. They come along. That's why I don't like the stage, because it looks like, well, that's so much for that stage of virtue. Well, I did that, and, you know, oh well. That was way back there, so we can forget that. But these are all friends of ours, are there supporting us and journeying with us, and we're gathering together our friends so that we can really do this together. And so we're gathering together our virtue. We're gathering together in concentration, so bring concentration in. We have friends in having view, purification of view. We have friends in overcoming doubt. We have friends in knowing what is and is not the path. We have friends in the way, the literal meaning of the word is the practice that we do. And those are six of those kind of purifications. And so we want to gather them together so they're here supporting us all along the path. We don't leave them behind. And I think they're very important, these to satisfy or meet some of the basic human needs that we have. And we don't do this practice to somehow ignore our human needs, ignore being human, but I think the practice is meant to really, in some ways, meet some of the important needs we have. So I said some of this before, but the purification of virtue, being virtuous, it's a wonderful friend for us. It really supports us. And it's a, I think of it as not just creating safety for us, we all need to be safe, but to have kindness and compassion, and to have a sense of living in the world where we're all family, we're all friends, we're all connected. The idea of virtue is not just something we do individually, it's very much how we live in the world with others. And so we want to gather together our friendship, our friendliness, our care for the world and for ourselves. This morning, I had a wonderful lesson making you all coffee. No, it wasn't. So I was down there making the coffee, in the early morning. And so, something was dripping or waiting. So I don't know how it was, but I looked in the refrigerator and I felt how much milk there was left. Now, this is what happened. I mean, exactly how it happened. I was getting my first cup of coffee. I poured some milk in, but there was only a little bit left. So I thought, not everyone knows where to get more milk is. So I would like, to be milk here when people come. So I went, I know where the milk is. So I went in the kitchen and got a thing of milk out. So it's just so someone else would come along later and have milk for their drink. So then I went to have later in the morning, just before breakfast, my second cup of coffee. So I was going to get the milk. So I reached down, and that old carton that was almost empty was still there, with about a half as much milk that I needed. So I poured that milk in, but I needed more. So guess what was behind it? Someone had put a new carton there. I had. And I thought, wow, it comes around. You do something nice for other people, and it comes back. I thought that was pretty cool. So, this virtue, living together in community, and caring for each other, and bringing together your, not just your living by the precepts, but your care and kindness. And perhaps as we go along and go into this practice, we need a lot of it to be able to keep forgiving, accepting, meeting, being kind to what's here and care for ourselves. There's nothing in Buddhism that I could see. I pore over these suttas quite a bit. There's nothing that I could tell that suggests in any way that we should treat ourselves anything less than in a dignified way, as valued people. And this kind of, strange teaching on not self, so many people think that that means they don't count. You count for a lot. You're important. So to care, to show up for yourself, and part of that caring and counting is to cultivate this quality of virtue. And then it's called the purification of mind, the collecting of the mind, the concentration of mind. And I said before, we all have a need for belonging. And this is a kind of way of belonging. The flip side of that is to say that what we learn in developing concentration practice is how not to abandon ourselves. And so easy to abandon ourselves and wander off in thought and stories and fantasies and delusion and lose touch. And so not to abandon oneself. Stay here. Come here. And what does it mean to stay here and really be here and not to abandon oneself? I kind of like the statue we have of the Buddha. It's a piece of art. We have no idea what the Buddha looked like. But it's kind of like an archetype, or it's kind of like represents a possibility for all of us. That person, that statue, is standing up confident, sitting up confident, upright. The chest is kind of out, not puffed out, but just kind of available or here. Not sunken, not holding anything back or not hiding anything, just here. And the wonderful gesture, he's reaching over to touch the earth, is a symbolic gesture of really being here. Really here. And this concentration practice, purification of mind, has a lot to do with purifying those forces, that centrifugal forces that spin us out into thought and preoccupations and be anywhere but here. And to learn how to be here with confidence and dignity and rooted and present with some strength, to really be here. And then there's a purification of view, which I think meets the need for truth. And this is where Vipassana practice begins, you know, with the support, the stability, the groundedness that we get from concentration. Then there's the knowing, the practice, the mindfulness practice. And it's a truth-telling practice. Then each time we note, we're telling the truth about something. When we talk honestly, you know, out loud, it's just mindfulness out, it's just noting out loud. It's mindfulness out loud. We note to note what's true. And we note, we show up in all these layers of truth. There's all these ways and truths in our lives. There's social truths and of our communities. There's personal truths. And then at some points in our lives, we want to, ideally, would be ready and come into an environment where we have a chance to kind of get deeper in to the truth. And some of the underlying kind of deepest kind of the operating systems or the underlying building blocks in which the rest of our lives are built. And that's one of the functions of Vipassana practice. And one of the functions of getting still and concentrated so the mindfulness can begin seeing not the kind of large scale or the conventional scale of life, but the underlying building blocks in which everything else is built. And if you can see where how it's built and where it comes from, it gives power, it gives insight, and it gives us a different way of relating and even working with the world that we live in. And so to meet the truth in some deep level. And so with Vipassana, that's kind of the task of mindfulness, is really be with what's true. It takes a while to learn what's true. In the story I told about doing interviews with Upandita, it's not quite true to show up and say, you know, oh, I was such a terrible day, and I was just so miserable, and I'm a hopeless meditator, and I don't know if what's true is that I'm discouraged. The rest is kind of stories. It's kind of associations. It's kind of building kind of abstractions around it, as opposed to in a dignified way, recognized what's true here. I'm discouraged. It's a world of difference. So to learn how to show up and be true and be with this. And then at this deeper level, the building blocks, there's something special and very precious or very valuable about seeing that there is an experience and the knowing of it. And what we're looking at here is a very simple experience, not like the experience of the retreat center, but the moment-to-moment little pieces of experience that make up the big picture. The ringing of the bell, the sitting of the on the platform with the feet against the cushion, the legs against the cushion, the sounds of the traffic, a thought, sensations in the belly, a breath coming in. So we're coming down to these building blocks that, you know, and so to see each of these little things and see there's also this knowing of it. And part of the function of the mental noting is to kind of help us begin to kind of appreciating that there's this distinct thing of knowing. The noting is not the same, but the way that Mahasi Sayadaw talked about noting, noting was knowing emphatically. Just a little more oomph in the knowing. And so it gets the mind kind of the idea. It gets the mind kind of in the groove, or gets the mind close to the place where knowing occurs, because you can't note without knowing, and then you know, then you know. So it's kind of like in the territory, and kind of pointing back to that. And that knowing is really something special. If you can really have a sense of a moment of knowing, a moment of mindfulness, it's infinitely forgiving. Because you, in that knowing, you don't have to bring with you the past. In the knowing itself. Brian talked this morning about two things, beginning and continuing. And you can begin at a moment's notice. And, you know, I don't know, if 50% of what we're doing here on the retreat is beginning again. Michael Jordan's failure rate was much less than ours. You know, if you're measuring success by staying mindful and staying not, you know, losing it, you know, we gotta, he missed how many shots of her career? You know, how many moments did you miss today? And how many times did reality trust you? He said, trust you with the game winning. How many times did the reality trust you with getting enlightened today? And how many times did you miss the shot? But you can always begin again. And the simplicity of knowing doesn't matter how many times you were lost in thought. It doesn't matter what happened 2 seconds ago. It's possible to discover in this simplicity of knowing something very special about just this moment. In the knowing of the direct experience of this moment, there's only this moment. The past can have a role, the future can have a role, you don't have to never have them again, but there's something very wonderful about just showing up. You don't have to bring with you a lot of stuff. You don't have to bring your backpack full of the past. You're allowed to put things down, the past down, at least temporarily. Just show up. And what happens when we start seeing knowing, the experience in the knowing, we start seeing the experience, what's happening here, freer from the overlay of abstract ideas, the bigger stories we make about it. And we start meeting another human need, which is to begin understanding what's going on here. What's happening here? And what's happening at the fundamental layer, this building block layer, is that things don't happen randomly. It's not pure chaos, in spite of how it feels sometimes. There's an event, and dependent or conditioned on that event, something else happens. And we can see that connection. There's a thought, and certain thoughts create body sensations. I've sat very peacefully, minding my own business, thank you, and not interested in stirring up any trouble whatsoever. But then this mind of mine will somehow, you know, maybe there was a car that drove by that had a certain kind of sound. Maybe the muffler was broken. That was a condition to remember the car that I had in high school. That muffler didn't work. Which reminds me of my girlfriend in high school. And then all this heat and energy comes welling up. It's like a little volcano, you know. I mean, I could warm up California. What she did and said, and how could she? And I can tell you, high school was long ago. You know, so you see, look, this happens, and this happens, and so with this arising, this happened. With this arising, this happened. Now, you could go in there, maybe analyze more detail the history of why this would come up, and but just this very simple thing, conditionality. And it's fascinating to watch the kind of cause and effect, or the condition and the consequence that goes on. And one of the reasons why this is so helpful, to kind of drop that trust then to be there, is we start seeing something. We start seeing how we interfere, how we get caught up in it. Something the Buddha called the knots, K-N-O-T-S, usually translated into English as the fetters. But how many times do you say fetter in your ordinary vocabulary? Do you even know what a fetter is? But knots. And now we get knotted. So there's the things we see, the sight object. There's the eye that knows it, kind of. And then there's what's in between, which we get entangled. We get caught up. I see the bell. There's the bell. I see it. And I want it. And then I'm entangled with it. I see something, I know it, and I don't want it, and now I want to get rid of it and push it away. So it starts by getting down to these building blocks of our experience and trusting, settling back, and just the simplicity, the simple experience moment by moment, we start seeing our relationship to it, how we get caught and involved. And then we can learn at some point that this is not so much fun. I don't think I want to keep living my life getting entangled, getting somehow abandoning myself. It's one of the ways we abandon ourselves, is getting entangled and caught up and in aversions and desires and things. And so the path, what is the path and not the path? What's not the path is anything having to do with clinging, with getting entangled. What is the path is the untying of the knots, disentangling, being free. So then whatever arises, we have a better chance of noticing if we get entangled, because of the hopefully the simplicity of awareness and all kinds of things that we get caught in. And one of the ways to know that we're caught is if we have left the present moment. I see the bell. I really want this bell. So I start thinking about how can I get it. I wonder how much I'd have to pay RRC. Or maybe if I bring a bigger one, they'd trade it for me. Or maybe I'm the teacher here, maybe I don't have to even ask. Or, you know, I've left the present moment long ago. I'm lying off in my scheming, right? So clinging is a way of, we lose something in the process of clinging. We lose ourselves, we lose the present moment, we lose the connection with what is true of the in the moment. And I, you know, sometimes it's a huge loss. I believe that some people lose live long lives and have lost their life long ago because they're so disconnected by how they're entangled. But as we, the continuity of practice, moment by moment, keeps showing up. And that's why the noting is so helpful, is if you keep a steady pace of a relaxed noting, you're much more likely to know that you've left the present moment. After a while, you'll get a sense of when you stop noting. And you'll get a sense or feel what it's like to, you know, note mechanically, and you're not really there anymore either. But if you don't note, it's a lot easier to get tricked into the kind of thinking you're present. You know, it's pretty good. You're sitting here and calm and settled. And the calm feelings are kind of still here. But the mind wanders off in thought. But the calm feelings are telling you you're kind of here. But you're wandering off in daydreams. But so the part of the function of the noting is to keep us on track. And as I said earlier, even people sometimes who don't like the noting, if they do it, eventually admit, you know, I'm actually more present when I note, even though it does seem a little bit more busy or something. So it's one of those kind of tools to help us. This thing about purification of what is and not the path meets another important need that human beings have, and that is a sense of purpose. It's a, you know, some kind of purpose in life, and it's a wonderful purpose. In Buddhism, we say it's the highest purpose, the purpose of not to cling, not to be in a certain kind of prison, not to be kind of in bondage, not to be... they use pretty dramatic language in the old days. I don't know how well we can get away with it anymore, but, you know, you get enslaved. They talked about, it's not good, this clinging. It's not like lightweight stuff we're talking about. We're talking about some of the deepest things that keep us limited. And to have a sense of purpose to become free of clinging. But I don't know if that language works for all of you. Maybe there's better language that says the same thing. But we don't just do it for ourselves, because it's so pervasive in our society and among our people, our wider communities, everywhere in ourselves, that people get somehow entangled or caught up and detached. And that sense of purpose to discover the possibility of not being attached, to live in the world free, we don't just do it for ourselves, but we do it for others. If we're on the path, if we're trying to explore and find out what that's like, then we join together with other people who are exploring and finding that. And we do it together and support each other and find our way. It's one of the great purposes. And so in Buddhism, that purpose is considered to be a noble purpose. So kind of elevating its value. And some people, having a sense of purpose, you know, they're okay. If that's the purpose, I'm doing it. This is important. So I'm going to sit down and I'm not going to waste time here, because this is the time. Let's be here. And then there's a purification of... usually in English it's translated as the way, patipata, which literally means the practice or the method. And now is a time in practice to really settle down with the continuity of just noting, just being aware, just being mindful moment by moment. And that's what's in store now. So you bring together the practice. And really, this is a time to be dedicated, to be devoted, to be committed to just the simple practice of showing up and noting, showing up and being present, showing up and being mindful for this moment, then this moment. Trying to do is hang in there, be continuous. Hopefully you've gathered enough of your friends, enough of your virtue friends, enough of your concentration friends, enough of your truth friends, enough of your knowing what's going on friends, enough of your purpose friends, you know, that you're ready to really settle down. And okay, let's get to work. Let's just the direct experience. That's where it's at. Now's the time. This is the time. Now I'm ready. Just a direct experience, moment by moment. And this is one of the long stage in the when the horses are taking the stages. And it's the repetition of doing it again and again, just being here. And I think of this as kind of like developing a craft. Or maybe if you're a dancer, learning to dance, or a musician, learning to play music. The necessity to repetition over and over again. And it's repetition to kind of train the mind. Just like an artist or a musician or a dancer or a craftsperson is training themselves through repetition over and over and over again. And we're beginning to train the mind in the skill and the craft of staying present, of showing up, of developing a certain kind of ease or a certain kind of naturalness even in being present for here, knowing this. But it takes a lot of moments to add up to develop a skill. So it's not a matter of just pushing the button and now suddenly you can just, be present, no problem. And if you just find that button, those teachers must know where that button is. You know, there must be a trick. There are probably better teachers out there who know what it takes. Just tell me how to do this. You know, it's like someone who wants to learn the piano, goes to the first lesson, and the teacher says, you go home and practice this for a while. Well, I guess that teacher was lousy. I'll go find a different teacher who can tell me how you do this, because I didn't learn that one. But you got to go through your thing, practice. And so it's shaping, crafting, developing, settling, refining. In the language of this thing we're doing this week, we're just purifying, shedding, so that we can kind of get closer and closer, more intimate, more connected to what's here. And as we get into it, it's this stage of purification of the way or the practice. Really enter into this when we start to becoming aware, or we start welcoming in how much our experience is coming and going, the flow, the ebbing and flow, the changing, the undulating. And there's a lot of it has to do with learning how to ride the waves, seeing the waves, and learning how to catch the waves or flow with the waves, or allow yourself to go up, be lifted by the waves and go down by the waves, and just kind of let the waves come through without being submerged by them or without being distracted by them, but just whatever comes, just let it come through you. Let it be received in the way it comes and goes. And you can't do that very well if you stay up in your mind telling stories. Or if you stay up and have, broad ideas, concepts of what things are. It's letting this conceptualizing, story-making part of the mind, giving it a vacation, giving it a break. The rising and passing. And sometimes as we get into this and get close, the experience of rising and passing begins to shift and change. It takes different forms. And one of the kind of fascinating forms is if you're in a train looking out the window perpendicularly and there's a mountains far in the way, the mountains kind of stay there and don't change much. But something that's maybe 100 yards away, the train goes by and you see it there for a little bit as it goes by. You see it appear and then it disappears. But then there are telephone poles that are right next to the tracks. The train is going fast enough. You don't see the poles appearing. All you see them going, going, because, you know, that's all that you're aware of. And so sometimes it can be like that. As we get more intimate, more concentrated, and really allowing ourselves to be in the flow, sometimes it can just feel like things are just dissolving and disappearing. And that could be fascinating. It could also be a little disorienting. And some people at this point in practice start getting disoriented or get a little troubled because we need to feel safe. And one way to feel safe is to hold on to ideas, meaning, purpose, hold on to ideas of identity, who I am. But if concepts and ideas are not available, and we really, then, you know, who am I? The way some people need to feel like they're in control, and we control through the vehicle or through the filter of these ideas and concepts and stories we make and stories we say about who I am and other people are and all kinds of things. And so in this unusual environment of just sitting, in the rising and passing of phenomena, without all those stories operating anymore, it's very disorienting for people whose sense of control came from them. And making things, people have a strong need for, an identity, being someone. But so much of what we think of as an identity, some of them, some identities are no problem. Some of them are kind of creative that people have. But if we need to have the identity, and the identity is experienced or known through thoughts, stories, concepts, comparisons to others, all kinds of things, as that layer of how we see reality is put to rest, and we're just in the moment-to-moment direct experience, some people find it very disorienting not to have their usual sense of self. And you know. So it's not unusual, occasionally, for some people to feel apprehensive, sometimes get afraid, who am I? Where's all this? And, you know, because it's so unfamiliar, this world of things dissolving and disappearing. It's not unusual for people to start seeing that world of phenomenon rising and passing as a little bit undesirable or not so interesting or a little bit, some people, the text sometimes call it, it's dangerous. What's dangerous is to get involved in it. So both afraid and also, you know, a little bit, that's not a safe place to go. And it's not unusual for people to start getting disenchanted with all that stories, the stories that we tell ourselves and live in, and the things that we're pursuing and hoping for, and the regrets that we're living in, where we tell ourselves the same story over and over again about what happened, or the planning we have for the future, or the fantasies we have, and all kinds of the attachments, starting getting disenchanted. And sometimes disenchantment is not happy. Sometimes it's more like really weary. Whereas earlier in practice with the concentration and the settling, getting into the flow and the rhythm of practice, there can be the corruptions or defilements of insight. All these great experiences can happen in the flow and joyful and open and light and equanimous. It's like, wow, I got it made now. And then this next layer, sometimes it's a little surprise that it's not so happy anymore because it's the feeling of disenchanted. Some people get discouraged and the task of teachers is to, one way or the other, tell you, don't get discouraged. That's maybe impossible. But maybe it's more possible is we can tell you, maybe it's more reasonable to say, don't believe your discouragement. Or don't let your discouragement dictate what you do. Because what you should do is just keep going. Moment to moment, showing up. Keep noting. keep being mindful. That's the place, that's where we take refuge in. Whether it's going pleasant or unpleasant, don't stop. Bhikkhu Bodhi said begin and then continue. Just continue, keep going. And and then at some point, this journey takes a new form. And this is kind of, yesterday Brian talked about this as the dark night of the soul time, perhaps. But then it takes a new form. And this, at some point, after we've had enough real, visceral, immediate experience of all this, and understanding how it all works, and no longer feeling attracted or interested, or feeling even little bit like enough already of all this stuff, there arises something that I call a biological imperative. A little piece of Gillism. And this is that there comes a desire for liberation. I really want to be free. And I experienced it as kind of, it wasn't that I wanted to be free, it was the biological system that wanted to be free. And this was a kind of a real revelation for me, because I had practiced in a Zen tradition where you weren't supposed to practice with any idea of a goal. And so that's fine. There's some wisdom in that tradition around that. But this was, I didn't have a goal. My body did. My psyche did. There's a biological imperative for freedom. And it's kind of welling up, yes, freedom. Nothing else was more important. This is what I want. And so that's the beginning of kind of letting go or moving beyond. If there is disorientation, discomfort, fear, sense of danger, sense of disenchantment, yes. And then the practice begins again. It always begins again. You're always beginning again. And now the practice gets really good. Now you get the real, now you're going to get the real instruction once you're there. Just note whatever's happening in direct experience. In the direct experience, just note, stay with the anchor, just keep noting it, be there with it, see it carefully. If something else arises that's predominant, know it. If it passes, know it. Just keep noting, stay. It's the same practice. But now it kind of comes with a little different oomph or value or a little bit different motivation, or there's less wind drag. There's like, now we're really kind of more into it and committed. And some of the same insights we've had before arise again, maybe clearer. There's the kind of seeing of how everything is inconstant and arising and passing. Seeing how there's a certain kind of unsatisfactoriness in everything that arises. And it's also a sense seeing that in all that occurs, in the moment-to-moment experience of it all, there's no self in those things. And then the practice moves in to what some people will call the final, some people say it's the penultimate step in the stage of purification, purification of the way, purification of the practice. So it's a kind of, we're spending two talks on this. And now we come to what's called the equanimity to all formations. A kind of a mouthful. But then formations means has two meanings. It's sankhara. It can mean all conditioned things, so anything in the universe. Or it could also mean anything that belongs to anything belonging to the mental world, mental activity, thoughts, impulses, intentions, volitions, anything that belongs to that part of the mind, that where the mind is kind of the mental activities of the mind. That's not consciousness or not perception. And now there's a profound state of equanimity. we don't practice equanimity, we kind of fall into it, we settle into it. And it's kind of like in the, some people know about the jhanas, the fourth jhana is characterized by equanimity. It's a very profound state. And this the feeling of its equanimity is considered to be some of the most sublime and satisfying emotions a person can have. Some people say, well, equanimity must be boring. It's like the best. It's like the sweetest. And then, but it's hard to believe because it's characterized by not really, nothing feels either pleasant or unpleasant. So how can it be pleasant if it's no pleasure? So you have to kind of go through it. It's so delightful. But now the mind, the main thing is the mind is unruffled by anything. No matter what happens, the mind is okay. It's cool, it's chilled, it's relaxed, it's at ease. It's receptive, it's interruptible, things just go right through. The mind doesn't pick it up, doesn't react. And what that does to the mind is that the mind then has a chance to go to deeper and deeper layers of stillness, of quiet. So the activities of telling stories is put to rest. The activities of holding on to things and wanting things and pushing things away have been put to rest. The activities of trying to figure out what's going on, the activities of trying to make something happen and cultivate. With the state of equanimity, there's no more fixing anything. When I was in this state, I didn't know that you were supposed to stop fixing things. So my teacher at some point said, leaned forward and said, Gil, stop fixing things. I was adjusting and trying to make things work better. And stop. Just no more fixing. So the mind doesn't even the kind of subtle movement for, against, wanting something, there's no wanting. There's no trying to do anything. There's no trying to get away from anything. So it allows the mind to become very still. And I don't know if this is an image that some of you like, but from, you know, I kind of grew up next to water, so really still, peaceful water. So still that it has reflections in it from the mountains nearby. So the mind becomes so still. And it's nice. But what the advantage of this is that as we experience it, as we kind of get into deeper and deeper layers of equanimity, what falls away, or what doesn't, kind of what fades away, is any kind of self-consciousness. Any kind of validating, or think, even the idea, this is cool, this is wonderful, is too much. So the equanimity becomes so still, so just allowing things to be. It may be related to what in some schools of Buddhism is called a mind that becomes like a mirror. A mirror is undisturbed by what comes through the mind. So I don't know if this is a nice image for you, but let me offer it. When my sons were young, we took them to these like discovery museums. And one of the things that they seemed to have these museums, kids' museums, kind of, was these big bowls where you would drop like a quarter or a marble, like marble into it. And there would be a hole at the bottom, a small little hole, but the momentum of the marble meant it just flew right over the hole, up the other side. And it was fun to watch the marbles go in all kinds of directions, and you know, just kind of, you know, and slowly would lose momentum. But if you leaned over and pushed the marble, it would keep the momentum going. And if you kept pushing it, it'll go forever. Up and down, and up and down, and up and down. And that's kind of what we're doing with the marbles in our head. You know, we have all these loose marbles in there. And we're constantly pushing them along and moving them along and moving them along and moving them along. So equanimity is when the marble begins losing its momentum, its speed. And the marbles begin settling down to the bottom there. And when the marbles are, you know, have no, almost no momentum anymore, then they come to the bottom where the hole is. And then they can fall through. They can let go. They can become free of kids pushing them around. Your mind, your marbles will finally be free of you, kind of like stirring up trouble. So the function of this equanimity of all formations is to help us slow down the marbles enough that something else can happen. And if you're waiting for something else to happen, there's too much momentum in the marbles. So that's why it's called equanimity. So settling into it, settling into it. And it turns out that the best way, the special secret instructions for what to do at this stage is just note your direct experience. just this. So we're training the mind, we're training ourselves at all these stages to do the same practice. Just show up for the direct experience. Just be present for it. Know it. And it is a training that becomes more and more useful as the mind gets trained and as we go along the journey. And the more developed that capacity is, the more that capacity will serve us and help us at these as further along on that path. So there's one more stage of purification, and that will be in a couple of days. This name of the game is begin and continue. And this is a very precious opportunity to be on a retreat like this. And it's just a matter of doing it, and being here and coming back, remembering how forgiving the practice is. Just start again. Don't have to feel bad about anything, because you start, as long as you start again, you're on the path. And then try to stay. So tomorrow we're going to have a day of silent practice. So we can kind of just, that's what it'll be. So there won't be any instructions in the morning or practice discussion during the day or a talk in the afternoon. The afternoon schedule will be slightly changed. So the sitting that before the Dharma talk will be 45 minutes ending at 4. Then there'll be a 45-minute walking period. And then 45 minutes before supper, we'll be back here to sit. And that'll be changed on the schedule, so you don't have to remember this. But is there someone who... Let's see, how do we do this? The person who rings the bell to bring us back to the Dharma talk, could you ring the bell to bring us back to the sitting at 4:45? And the person who rings the bell for the who practices later for 3:15, who's that? 3:15 sitting. So you'll sit up here and ring the bell to end the sitting at 4:00. And then will you be able to sit up here to be the practice leader from 4:45 to 5:30? Great. He's sitting up here. Yeah.
From 3:15 to 4.
And it's a sitting. So the person who rings the 3:15. Yeah. So. So I think that to prepare ourselves for the transition from this talk for the next period through tomorrow, let's take a minute to reestablish your meditation posture and perhaps in your own way that works for you, to take a meditation posture that somehow or other expresses, like the Buddha statue, you being grounded here and with some confidence and dignity here, fully here.